The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
G'day everybody and welcome to City Bible Forum. My name's Craig Josling and I'm pleased that you're here today. Hope you enjoy the meeting. We're continuing our series going through the Gospel of Mark, looking at the person and the teaching of Jesus. And the topic today is religion and prejudice. So the issue is, does Jesus divide people and separate people? Or does Jesus bring people together and unite people? That's basically the topic that we're looking at today. The format is our speaker, Al Stewart, will get up in a minute and speak for about 20, 25 minutes. Then there'll be a chance for you to write down questions or comments on the bit of paper inside your program. We'll collect those up. Al will have a go at answering them. So please be brave and bold and write your questions down on those bits of paper. I'm going to read part of the Bible section that Al will be referring to today. If you'd like to open up your program, it's from Mark chapter 7. And I'll just be reading from verses 24 to 30. Jesus left that place and went to the vicinity of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know it. Yet he could not keep his presence secret. In fact, as soon as she heard about him, a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an impure spirit came and fell at his feet. The woman was a Greek, born in Syrian Phoenicia. She begged Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. "First let the children eat all they want," he told her, "for it is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to the dogs." "Lord," she replied, "even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." Then he told her, "For such a reply you may go. The demon has left your daughter." She went home and found her child lying on the bed and the demon gone.
Well, good afternoon. Great to see you here. How's this for volume? I always get into trouble for breaking people's eardrums when I get up. So you're half deaf, Ian Powell. Does that sound about right? Excellent, thank you. All right, here's a question for you. When you find a really funny YouTube clip, okay, now this is never at work, I mean at home, right, what's the first thing you want to do? You want to share it with someone, right? I found an absolute howl. I only fell off my chair with one the other day. First thing I want to do, I had three or four mates that I sent it to straight away. Why? Because when you've sent it to someone and you've laughed about it together, then it's even funnier. Right? We want to share things. Or when you find a piece of music that you really like, first thing we want to do, share it with people. Or have you ever been to the movies on your own? It's not much fun. It's kind of sit there, Nigel, no mates, and you want to go and share things with people. I think we're actually hardwired to want to have relationships. We want to be part of I think the buzzword today is community. We want to have things together with people. It's kind of ironic in a way that our society, the ability to communicate has made these quantum leaps now that you can talk to anyone, anywhere on the planet, any time. And yet, as a society, you're actually becoming more and more isolated. So if you check the Australian Bureau of Stats figures, over the last, kind of during the 20th century, in broad terms, the size of the average Australian household has almost halved from 4.6 people to 2.6 people. So, and continuing to decline. And over the last 30 years, the number of people living alone in our society has increased by 50% to about one person in four. Now, there's nothing wrong with living alone. Lots of people enjoy it. Great, if you like it. But the flip side, of those one in four people, many of them struggle with loneliness. We're wired up to want community, to be together. Now, there's an irony, though, that same desire for community, to want to be part of a group, has a dark side. And the dark side is us and them. And it's that kind of, we're here, we're the in-group, so to speak, and those other guys, for whatever reason, they're on the outer, and so we look down our nose at them. And whether that be one race looking down their nose at another race, and racism, unfortunately, still alive and well in this country, or it might be one ethnic group despising another, or it might be one social class, and you get, you know, snobbery and reverse snobbery, that's just as strong. Or it might be over politics, or it might be over gender, or it might be over gender and politics at the moment. It's kind of in the media. It might even be geography. Do you know, is there anybody here from Tasmania? I'll just check. Anyone? Do you know, if you go to Tasmania, the people in Launceston have a real rivalry with the people in Hobart. Really? Over all sorts of... True, they do. It's only kind of that far apart, but no, it matters to them. And I just wonder, we live in such a divided world, divided at the level of, you know, of racism and classism and ethnicity. Why can't we all just get on? Couldn't we all just live as one? That was the dream that John Lennon had as he wrote that song 30 years ago. And it is, I mean, in one level the lyrics drive me mad, but in another level it's just this hauntingly beautiful song. I won't sing it for you, but you remember some of the words. Imagine there's no countries, it isn't hard to do, nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will live as one. Do you notice that first, verse, it's the second verse of the song I showed you there. He mentioned, and no religion too. And he's right, actually, isn't it? That religion divides. It does. There's no hiding from it. One of the great criticisms of religion, one of the kind of javelins that stick, is that religion divides people. Now, we all have racial, I think I could say that, we all have kind of racial and ethnic prejudices. But when you combine that with religion, it makes them so much more powerful, doesn't it? Especially if I can think that looking down my nose at you and God's on my side. Okay, and God actually approves of me because I'm with God and you are not, and that's, woo, that kind of lifts the temperature on everything. Now, the background of the part of the Bible we're looking at today, in the first century, the religious leaders of Jesus' nation or tribe thought of outsiders, well, to the point where they called outside people outside their ethnic group dogs. Here's a couple of examples. Rabbi Eliezer, prominent around the first century, you know, more or less contemporary of Jesus, he said, whoever eats with an idolater is like a man who eats with a dog. Or the Midrash, written on Exodus across a number of centuries, says, the ungodly are like dogs. So, yeah, religion does divide racially, ethnically, and so on. It reinforces prejudices. But here's what I want to look at with you today. Was Jesus and the movement that he started and that continues, is that part of the problem or was it part of the solution? If you want to really sharpen it up, what I want to look at with you today is what was Jesus' attitude to outsiders, to those who were racially and ethically different to him? Because did you notice, have a look at the program, the part of Mark's Gospel printed out there, and I think actually in a triumph of administrative planning, I think this you've got a subtly different version of the Bible to what I've got in my notes. So my apologies if there's a word different here or there. My fault. I don't think it'll make much difference, but there might be just a word different here or there. But you notice in verse 27, it really does appear that he calls her a dog. So what's going on there? It hardly fits with gentle Jesus, meek and mild. Everywhere else, someone comes to Jesus, asks for help, and they get compassion and understanding and they get looked after. It seems that Jesus calls this woman a dog. What's going on? And the other hard thing to work out here is if you look over into chapter 8 that's printed out there, the disciples, two chapters earlier, they've seen Jesus feed a crowd of 5,000 people with a handful of bread rolls. And Jesus says to them now, how are we going to feed this big crowd of 4,000 people? And they go, don't know, like, no idea. I think, if you'd seen Jesus feed a crowd of 5,000 people a week or so earlier, you'd kind of remember that, wouldn't you? And so what's going on? Amnesia? Let's see if we can make sense of it. what's Jesus' attitude to the outsider? Now, what I need to do, though, is just take a step back and take you through what we looked at last week. If you weren't here, you'll get it just fine. Jesus is in the northern part of Israel. I've got a map here that that'll show you. I hope you can see that. The lake in the top of the map, the lake or the Sea of Galilee, Jesus is across to the west of that at the beginning of chapter 7 in the area of Israel. The big question that these chapters are asking is, who is acceptable to God? Or to put it in the terms of the first century, who is clean before God? Nothing to do with germs, but who's clean? Who is acceptable to God? And Mark chapter 7 verse 1, here's what we looked at last week. The Pharisees, they were the religious leaders of the day. The Pharisees and some of the teachers of the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus and saw some of his disciples eating food with hands that were unclean. That is, unwashed. Now they don't mean they had germs on them. They mean they hadn't been ceremonially, ritually, religiously washed. Okay, and so Mark tells us, gives us the background, the very next verse. The Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they give their hands a ceremonial washing, holding to the tradition of the elders. When they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash, and they observe many other traditions, such as the washing of cups and pitchers and kettles. This was all in addition to the Old Testament, all added that they'd made up their own traditions. Verse 5, so the Pharisees and the teachers of the law asked Jesus, why don't your disciples live according to the tradition of the elders instead of eating their food with unclean hands? They washed after they'd been in contact with the Gentiles because, the Gentiles were unclean. They washed for a whole lot of reasons. And Jesus' answer is this: all the religious rituals, all the washings, the food that you eat have no effect at all on whether or not you're clean before God. Why? Because the problem is not what you eat or washing your hands. The problem is your heart and the selfishness within us that leads to evil actions that we do. We saw that last week. You might like to read the beginning of Mark chapter 7 or listen online if that would help. So religious rules, regulations, outsiders, who's clean before God? And the very next story is about a woman who is unclean in their eyes. See, verse 24, Jesus left that place and went to the vicinity of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know it, yet he could not keep his present secret. Jesus just wanted some peace and quiet. If you've been reading along with us, back in chapter 6, he's trying to find somewhere to go and have a rest. He says to his disciples, let's go to the other side of the lake, have a rest. And there's a huge crowd there. And I think he keeps pushing further and further north to just try and get some peace and quiet with his dozen or so disciples. In fact, way back in chapter 3, they've been so busy that they didn't have time to eat properly. Interesting, Mark tells us that as the crowds came, even from way up into the Gentile area, you'll notice up in Tyre, see the top of the map, beautiful, I don't know who's doing that, but well done. Tyre, you see it says Matthew chapter 15, that's Matthew's account of this same story, Matthew's version of what happened here. And so Jesus is pushed way up further to the north, and yet people from up there had heard about him and they're mentioned as seeing him earlier on. Well, what happens? Verse 25. In fact, as soon as she heard about him, a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an evil spirit came and fell at his feet. Now, Mark gives us an unusual amount of detail about this woman. The woman was a Greek, born in Syrian Phoenicia. She begged Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. This lady had all... Forgive me for saying, this lady had all sorts of problems in the eyes of the first century. Firstly, she was a woman, which made her a second-class citizen in the eyes of most religious people. She was a Greek and therefore a Gentile, therefore an outsider. She was from Syrian Phoenicia. The Phoenicians were a coastal people who, cities on the coast around the Mediterranean, in that culture and administratively linked to Tyre, is what Mark tells us there, Syrian Phoenicia. And you notice in verse 25, her daughter here's where the problem. Your version that's printed says, what about the spirit? Can someone tell me? Impure. Yeah, sorry, that's what I noticed. It's just a translation done a slightly different year. Impure, literally the word in the original is unclean. So her daughter had an unclean spirit. So this woman's, there's any number of ways where she is an outsider, an outcast. She is unclean. Her daughter is unclean and so on. And somehow she's found Jesus, pushed her way into the house, begged Jesus to heal her daughter. And the answer is not what you might expect from gentle Jesus, meek and mild. Verse 27, first let the children eat all they want, he told her, for it's not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs. Now, there's something to tell you in the original language here, and I don't always like doing this because the English translations are so accurate. But the word for dog that Jesus uses is unusual. There's two words for dog in the New Testament. The general word for dog is the big, mean, scary thing that growls at you, eats garbage and runs around the streets. And Jesus mentions that, say, in the Sermon on the Mount, beware of the dogs that'll bite you. But the word he uses here, the language, it's a diminutive of dog, meaning it's a little dog. It's a house dog. It's a puppy kind of thing, all right? More. It's a dog that lives in your home. Now, we happen to have a dog, and here he is. This is Musket. He's 7 years old. Musket's natural environment is upside down in front of the heater for about 6 months of the year. He runs the house pretty well in the morning. Kathy kind of wanders up to get a cup of coffee. He follows her up. She turns the heater on. He lies in front of the heater. She goes back downstairs. Anyway, it's a dog's life. Now, there's one iron rule in our family about the dog, and that is the dog doesn't eat at the same time as we do. He's got to learn that we're the boss, he's the dog, and that rule is enforced with iron discipline, as long as Kathy's at the table. People eat first, then the dog. Now, what's Jesus saying? It's still a hard thing to say, isn't it? And yet, it's kind of built on that same rule. Matthew's gospel adds a little piece of information that's handy for us to understand. Matthew chapter 15 verse 23, as he retells the same story, says this. Jesus did not answer a word, so his disciples came to him and urged him, send her away, for she keeps crying out after us. He answered, I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. What's he mean? That Jesus' mission for those 3 years as he walked, walked and taught and so on, that was to Israel. It was a timing thing. He had come, first of all, to call them back to the true faith, you know, to know their God, to call them back. And then later, after the crucifixion, the resurrection, then it would be time for the Gentiles. But Jesus' priority for those 3 years is the house of Israel. Now's not the time. It's like he's saying, I think this is what he's saying to her, lady, you've kind of interrupted the meal. You've got to feed the kids first. You feed the little dogs later on. And the other thing is, Jesus didn't plan this. He'd come up to actually get some peace and quiet to teach his disciples, and he knows exactly what will happen if he heals this woman's daughter. It's what happened in chapter 1. He'll be mobbed, because you can really heal, the sick people will come. So now's not the time. But look at what she says. Verse 28, yes, Lord, she replied, but even the dogs, under the table eat at the even the little dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. What's he saying? I can eat at the same time. I'm just a puppy. I won't interrupt things, but you can feed me at the same time. Do you know, in the whole of Mark's gospel, and I've checked this, I was surprised to find it, this woman is the only one that calls him Lord. Everyone else calls him teacher, but this pagan, Gentile, outcast woman calls him Lord. And trusts him. In fact, begs. You know what? It has been scientifically proven you don't have to interrupt a meal to feed a little dog. Kathy's not here, so I'm feeling brave. Especially when someone's son has taught the dog to sit up straight and kind of do a high five. And as soon as someone's not watching, he's up and high five and he gets fed from the table and so on. I'm just a little puppy. Feed me while we go. And she calls him Lord, she begs, and look at what Jesus says. I think Jesus basically says, lady, you win. You got me. Verse 29, then he told her, for such a reply you may go, the demon has left your daughter. Trust, she reaches out to him, she calls him Lord, he gives her what she needs. She went home and found her child lying on the bed and the demon gone. And what you begin to see as Jesus travels in the north, in this Gentile area, the inevitable happens. I won't read through, see verse 31. Then Jesus left the vicinity of Tyre and went through Sidon down to the Sea of Galilee and into the region of the Decapolis, Deca, 10, Polis city, the 10 cities. You see the box on the right, the right-hand edge of the map, over there on the eastern side, that's the Decapolis, the 10 cities, predominantly Gentile area. And Jesus is there. In verses 33 through to 37, he heals the man who's deaf and mute. Kind of sign language thing happening, so he knows who is healing him and how, and the people are amazed. And what happens? It's the same thing as happened back in chapter 1. The crowds arrive. See 8 verse 1. During those days, another large crowd gathered. Since they had nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said, I have compassion for these people, and they've already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them home hungry, they'll collapse on the way because some of them have come a long distance. His disciples answered, but where in this remote place can anyone get enough bread to feed them? 2 chapters earlier, these same guys have seen Jesus do the feeding of the 5,000. There's a few less people here. Now, why don't they say, well, come on, Lord, come on, teacher, you can do this. Let's do the thing again with the bread and the... Why not? Why don't they think of that? Well, keep reading, 8 verse 5. How many loaves do you have? Jesus asked. 7, they replied. He told the crowd to sit down on the ground. And when he'd taken the 7 loaves and given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples and set them before the people, and they did so. They had a few small fish as well. He gave thanks for them also and told the disciples to distribute them. The people ate and were satisfied. Afterwards, the disciples picked up 7 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. About 4,000 men were present. And having sent them away, he got into the boat with his disciples and went to the region of Dalmanutha, which is probably on the western side of the lake over in a Jewish area, because you see that's where the religious leaders confront him. Why not? Why could they say, didn't they say, well, Lord, let's do the thing with the bread loaf, the bread and the fish again and answer? I don't think they could comprehend the Jewish Messiah, or certainly the Jewish prophet, because they haven't quite nailed it about him being the Messiah yet, the great Jewish prophet doing that miracle for the Gentiles. I think that's the only thing that makes sense of their lack of understanding. They could not think of him doing that. Then the religious leaders meet him again, ask for a sign, some kind of overwhelming thing from heaven. I mean, Jesus just fed 2 crowds of thousands with a few bread rolls, and that's not enough, and it makes even Jesus sigh. And I think what Mark's showing us here, you see, who's clean, who's acceptable before God? You've got the religious leaders with all of their rituals, all of their washings, all that kind of, that sort of thing, and yet they will not trust Jesus in the face of overwhelming evidence. And this Gentile woman who's, for all the normal markers, is kind of an outcast, and she reaches out to Jesus in trust and gets what she needs. Now, it's absolutely true, as you read the Gospels, Jesus is sent to the lost sheep of Israel. That's his priority. But as you read the Gospels, whenever a Gentile, whenever a person, outcast, a Gentile person comes to him and asks for something, they receive compassion and blessing. They get what they need. So in John chapter 4, Jesus meets a Samaritan woman, and she's had a really rough life, and yet Jesus reaches out to her and she's transformed and forgiven. In Matthew chapter 8, Jesus is amazed at the faith or the trust of the Roman centurion. In chapter 17 of Luke, Jesus heals 10 lepers. There's only one who comes back and thanks him, and Jesus particularly remarks, that man was a Samaritan who came back. Now, it's not a surprise, because right from the beginning of the Bible, God's had a concern for the whole of humanity, for all the world. So when God steps into history and speaks to Abraham and promises Abraham that that God will make him into a great nation, the last of the great promises given to him, though, is that the whole world will be blessed through Abraham's family. As the nation of Israel are brought out in the Exodus, about 1300 BC, brought into the promised land, part of their duties was to show the world how good and wise and gracious God was as they lived as his people. Through the Old Testament, there's all sorts of stories of Gentiles being brought to know the God of Israel. Rahab and Ruth and Naaman and you know, the stories that launched a million Sunday school lessons. They're there. And as you read the Gospels, yes, it's Jesus' priority, the house of Israel, but as soon as Jesus is resurrected, what's the command that comes? Go into all the world and make disciples of all nations. All nations. Now, it took the early Christians, it took the apostles, the sent ones, and the early Christians some time to work out the implications of the Christian message going to all nations. What I didn't realise until recently was there's a huge percentage of Jewish people living around the Roman Empire. They were Hellenised, they'd been influenced by Greek culture and so on, but still Jewish. As much as 10% of the Roman Empire were Jewish people. And huge numbers of those people adopted Christianity. They chose Jesus as their Messiah. But attached to them, in relationship with them, were many, many Gentiles. And the question was, as the Gentiles became followers of Jesus, did they have to adopt Jewish culture? Did they have to adopt the food laws and be circumcised and follow all the customs and culture and so on? And it took a while for that to be worked out, much prayer, head scratching and so on. But the answer is, you find it in Acts chapter 15 and so on, the answer is no, they don't have to take on all that culture. They keep their own culture. What do? They serve Jesus, love God, love your neighbour, honour Jesus in how you live. See, to be Christian is not to give up your ethnicity, not to give up your race or your language or your food or your music or all of those things. In fact, that diversity can be celebrated. They're good things from God. I know we've got a home group that meets at our place. Some people who are brand new Christians, some people investigating, but the beginnings of a Christian group together. I think one day we counted, we had 18 people in the room, we had a dozen heart languages that people spoke, a dozen different languages, Middle Eastern, European, and Asian and so on. And I'll tell you something, the food in that group is sensational, right? You celebrate that as well. It's a good gift of God. You don't have to give up all of those things to be a Christian. There is no Christian language. There is no Christian food. There is no Christian music. Now, Christians have food, language and so on, but there's no prescribed language, food, culture. It's bigger than that. Now, like I say, I'll speak carefully, and I think this is right. For Islam, if you're going to pray, many of the prayers have to be in Arabic, even if you can't speak Arabic. And the Quran is written in Arabic, and the Quran is supposed to be a copy. The Quran in heaven is written in Arabic. That's the language of God. Christianity's never been like that. From the very beginning, the Christians began to translate the Bible into the heart languages of people. Now, what holds it together? It's the heart language. Jesus says people will worship him in spirit and in truth, not in a particular place or in a particular language. All right? Our problem, if I could say, our problem today, and you see why it happens, is we confuse what the New Testament means by church with denominations, institutions and sandstone buildings. You can see why that happens. What the Bible means by church or the New Testament is much more like our word community, people gathered together. And that was so powerful in the growth of Christianity. You probably heard me, if you come occasionally hear me rabbit on about Rodney Stark, an American academic and so on. Well, why should today be any different? Let me show you. Rodney Stark, I don't think Professor Stark's a Christian. As far as I can tell, he's not. But he is an objective observer and brilliant writer of history. In his book, The Rise of Christianity, he talks about the fundamental thing that meant Christianity exploded across the ancient world and eventually, you know, took over the Roman Empire. What was it? Well, I'll show you. He says this. Let me state my thesis. Central doctrines of Christianity prompted and sustained attractive, liberating and effective social relations and organisations. You read that six times, what's it mean? It means the Christian message brought communities into being that transformed lives, cities and eventually an empire. He goes on to say, in my judgment, a major way in which Christianity served as a revitalization movement within the empire was in offering a coherent culture that was entirely stripped of ethnicity. All were welcome without need to dispense with ethnic ties. Yet for this very reason, among Christians, ethnicity tended to be submerged as a new, more universalistic, and indeed cosmopolitan norms and customs emerged. This way, Christianity first evaded and then overwhelmed the ethnic barrier that had prevented Judaism from serving as a basis for revitalization. All right? Bring your ethnic things, your food, your music, your culture, your language, but there's something bigger that holds the group together. He even says that it didn't just cross ethnic, it crossed power and class barriers as well, which were huge in the ancient world. His new book, Triumph of Christianity, he says, indeed, the church was an independent social sphere wherein high status was entailed by positions within the group, whatever one's status outside. A separate world wherein a high city official and a slave could meaningfully call one another brother or sister. And it's exactly what the New Testament says. So the Apostle Paul writes and says about the Christian community, here there is no Greek or Jew, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave or free, but Christ is all and is in all. Meaning it's Jesus that holds people together. And the relationship with him is bigger and more important than anything else, which means unity is possible. In fact, God's plan is to build a community, not just in this world, but in the new age, if you like. Heaven is a picture of community together. So the Apostle John has a vision of what heaven will look like in Revelation chapter 7. I'll just quickly read it to you. He says, after this I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count, from every nation and tribe and people and language, standing before the throne and in front of the Lamb. That Lamb being a metaphor picture for Jesus. You see, every tribe, nation, people, language, they'll be there. And those great things haven't been wiped away. They're celebrated. There's something bigger that holds them together, knowing God. And so, folks, the Christian message is anything but prejudice. Jesus says, love your neighbour. In fact, love your enemies. And what's God's plan? To bring together people from every tribe and language and social class to know him and to care for one another. You know, it's interesting that Jesus had the same passion as John Lennon, that we might live as one. Only Jesus' vision is not based on wishful thinking and a beautiful song. It's based on people knowing their Creator, finding forgiveness because of the price he paid, and so being able to forgive and love one another. And Jesus offers that community to those who follow him. Craig? Okay. We use the words race and racism, but isn't there just one human race from one Adam? So Acts chapter 17 verse 26, which says, from one man God made all of humanity. Yes, at that level, the idea is that you see the Bible tracks us back to actually all being descended from the man and the woman and so on. And so, yes, we are all have that in common. We're all equal. The Bible says we're all made in the image of God. And yet at the same level, at the same time, we have different cultures and people look different sufficiently to say, well, there's one race and there's another. So my wife is Chinese. I'm a white man, as she calls me. We're different races. Okay, that's true. And completely equal before God. Mark chapter 7 verse 27, why did Jesus call the Greek woman a dog? Let me see if I can go over it again. It's a kind word, it's the puppy word. He's saying it's an order thing, now's not the time. You feed the children first and then you feed the dogs, house dogs after that. You've interrupted a meal. In a little while it'll be time, but not now. And she says, you can feed the puppies at the same time as the kids. And Jesus says, you got me, lady. Okay. That's what I think is going on. Kind of free translation. It's a timing thing. A difficult question here. Jesus, Christianity and barriers. What about sexism? The great barrier between, between between the two halves of all people. Sexism seems to live in the New Testament. I don't think it does. It's interesting to read the histories of the times, how many more women converted to Christianity than men, because within Christianity, women were treated so much different and so much better. Rodney Stark's book, the one I quoted, The Rise of Christianity, has a big chapter on the numbers of women who became Christian and why, because they weren't subject to forced abortions because their husbands chose that. Little girls weren't exposed to die as the ancient world so often did. Women were treated, given rights and so on. And surprisingly for the ancient world, educated by the Christians. Now, women and men in the New Testament, in the Bible, are completely equal before God. So Galatians chapter 3, verse 28, there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. And he's talking about how it is that you become right with God through trusting Jesus. Male and female, exactly equal. However, the New Testament does say they're not the same. And the roles of men and women are not interchangeable. Okay? Now, the Bible talks about headship and submission. Here we go. I'm ready to be tarred and feathered out, perhaps off the carpet, but outside. The Bible talks about headship and submission. And what does it mean? It talks about the duty of a husband, say, within marriage, to love and care for, to lead, to lay down his life for his wife, and for her to willingly respond to that loving care and leadership. All right? It's because they have different roles. Now, are they equal? Yes. And because when Paul's looking for a way to explain that, he says the relationship of headship and submission is the same as the relationship within God himself between God the Father and God the Son. Meaning Jesus, fully God, truly, just that headship and submission role doesn't diminish either party. They're equal. They just have different roles. Now, Christians do disagree about how those roles are worked out exactly, sometimes within marriage and sometimes within Christian ministry, within the congregation and so on. But in terms of women's status before God and the way that they're right with God and so on, and their value, exactly equal with men. Just their roles are not interchangeable. Now, I'll get an argument from some people who are Christian on that second bit, okay? But on the equal before God, couldn't be clearer. Well, I think the whole lot's clear, but some will argue about the second part. Now, do you want to... how much time have we got, Craig, or have we done? Happy to push that around if you... We're finished. Okay, happy to stay. If you want to come talk to me about that, more than happy.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.